This is FM 100.5 and 101.9. AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
Good afternoon. Well, afternoon. And it's going to be a great day, no matter what the weather is outside. I had Fred Rolliter on with me, who everybody knows is a professor out at the university. And he's pretty multifaceted. He's going to be a really great guest. And he's been on before. And want to let you know that this portion of the show is brought to you by Blue Restaurant and Bar, located in the Jackson Heights Plaza. They have something for everyone on their menu, from steaks, fresh seafood, pastas, salads, appetizers, and special items unique to Blue. They have six items for lunch at just $6. Enjoy their Sunday live jazz with Avant Lane and Larry Pinkerton, and that's at brunch at 10 a.m., whether it's enjoying the courtyard at dinner, the game on the big screen TVs, or piano music Friday and Saturday evenings, there's something for everyone at Blue. Blue Restaurant and Bar, located in the Jackson Heights Plaza. Be sure to visit their website at blue-restaurant.com. Blue Restaurant and Bar owners Marty Brown and Greg Pogue. Fred, it's always good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you, Truman.
I think last time I saw you was, yesterday.
Yesterday, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he was up there pestering me like he usually does at church. You know, that's Truman.
Fred is our Sunday school teacher and does a magnificent job. And I don't care what you ask him, he can answer the question. And I've always marveled at that, because I try to pick the toughest questions that I can answer. And you're always able to do it. I don't know how you do it.
Well, part of it's bluff, you see. You don't know what I'm telling the truth or not. Besides that, the audience really needs to know that if I turn my back, you steal my books.
You're not supposed to tell that. Okay. I learned that in school.
That's right. I probably did the same thing.
Now, we're going to talk about a lot of interesting subjects, and one of my favorite is Mary Drusilla King, and she was in our church, and her history is not known to many people around here, but she is extraordinary.
Oh, she really is extraordinary. She's born about 1915, way out in Milton, mm-hmm. out in the country from Milton. Mm-hmm. You know, that'd be pretty far back in 1915.
Mm. Yes, it would be.
That would have been out the Las Casas Pike, and that was a turnpike, a toll road out that way. Mm-hmm. And to the King family, she was the second of seven children. She had an older brother. Mm-hmm. And they were big members of Milton Baptist Church, and she loved to go to school. But when she got through the eighth grade, Mama and Daddy made her stop going to school in order for her to take care of the younger children.
And that was pretty common back
then.
That
was very, very common for mm-hmm. the girls at that time particularly. Mm-hmm. And even often boys were just put to work in the fields. Yes, Tennessee had a compulsory education law of 16 by then, but it was not necessarily observed out in the country. Mm-hmm. She spent the 1930s, the Depression years, taking care of her siblings. It was a pretty tough time for farmers in Rutherford County.
Tough for everybody.
Tough for everybody around the world. And in 1941, she got a job with a government agency, I think in Nashville. I know mm-hmm. it was a government agency related to the war, and worked there. Other children were pretty, you know, up where they could take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. And she worked there for 4 years. And when she got out, she decided she was going to go on back to school. Now, at this point, she is 30 years old.
Mm.
Not your typical college student, not your typical high school student at this mm-hmm. time. And she had to have a high school education. She found out there was a Baptist junior college down in South Mississippi that you could get a GED high school equivalency degree in 1 year.
Wow.
And she went down there and did it and came back, and she's going to go to MTSU. And she does go to MTSU. She graduates mm-hmm. in 50, I think. You know, I think she took the full four
years. That's amazing.
And that's tough to do back then. But it wasn't so unusual because lots of the young men in college were close to her age because they'd been in the military and the GI Bill had come out. Of course, she didn't have the GI Bill to pay way.
Mm-hmm.
But she saved her money from the government job. She was doing all right. But in the summers, an interesting thing happened. They had been very strong members of Milton Baptist Church. And the local Baptist had hired a fellow named O.M. Nicholson as their director of missions, the modern term, to work with all the churches in Rutherford County. And he had a bright idea. He thought he got somebody to buy him a tent, and he would go out and preach revivals in the summer. Every 2 weeks, he'd move that tent around. And he would often preach in new areas. And when he went in a new area, he would get Drusilla King to go and do vacation Bible school during the day for the children. And he preached to the adults at night. They started Woodbury Road Baptist Church. They started Nolensville Baptist Church. They started Emmanuel Baptist Church. They started several churches exactly that same way.
That's amazing.
And they were, she was working as hard in the summer as she was in during the regular year, probably getting paid nothing or very, very little, maybe a little expense money. And when she got through, now she's 35 years old. She could have gone to school teaching. She had a teaching degree. But she felt called to work with children in some sort of mission setting. And she went with the Home Mission Board, who after a couple of times in the NOAA sent her to the Rio Grande River Valley.
Oh my.
And she worked with Hispanic children, starting kindergartens for Hispanic children all up and down the Rio Grande River Valley for about 20-25 years.
What got her attention to go down there?
I think it was just an assignment from the Southern Baptist Home Mission Board, what's now the North American Mission Board. They just said, we can use your skills there.
Right.
And she went. She was very successful at doing it. Didn't just start kindergarten. She started Hispanic Baptist Church after Hispanic Baptist Church after Hispanic Baptist Church down there. And then in the mid-1970s, early to the mid-1970s, her mother became sick. The family sold the farm, and Mama moved into town fairly close to Southeast Baptist Church, Wren Street, Cardinal Street, one of those right in there. The family just said, nobody's here to take care of Mama, and you're single, so you got to come home.
Wow.
And come home she did, but take care of Mama. But she also then went out and started Rockville's kindergarten. She liked to start kindergarten. She could get those kids started. And joined Southeast Baptist, became an active member there, just as active as could be, although we had to have a special thing for her. By the time she retired from teaching, which I think was 70 or maybe 72, because she didn't have lots of retirement pay built up, her eyesight wasn't the best. And there was a little section of four parking places off to one side in the church that was separated from the rest. That became Drusilla King's special parking place. She thought we were doing this to honor her and to give her a place she could go to. Actually, we're doing it to protect our cars. Because otherwise they got banged up when she tried to park.
I remember her having the what we call Coca-Cola bottle type glasses.
Yes,
her,
she sure
her eyes
did.
Were so large. But one thing I remember more about her than anything was her vitality, and she was always smiling. I never saw her when she was always smiling.
And I think that's why the kids loved her. I mean, she was full of life and humor and talked to everybody, and you know, and the kids thought she was wonderful, you know, even though she was by now their grandparents or their great-grandparents' age, probably.
In some ways, I think her history reminds me a little bit about Miss Mary Hall. They kind of match a little bit.
They do, don't they?
Yeah.
They came out of rural Rutherford County. They had a difficult time getting started, but they absolutely weren't going to stop until they got where they thought they ought to be. Education made all the difference there. And it was hard to get before World War II. Nowadays, we think every kid goes to school. In fact, truthfully, in high school and particularly in college, there are more girls than there are boys. It's close to 60% at lots of the colleges. But back then, it was the other way around. The boys got the education. The girls scrambled for what they could get.
You know, we've come a long way the way we treat the ladies. And I remember one of the big stories from Miss Mary Hall herself was that she did not want to be a teacher. She wanted to be a doctor. Her was a doctor.
That's right.
And he told her that she could not be a physician.
Well, the families often did these sort of things. They just simply said, you cannot go to that level. You know, you can't get the education. We won't help you do it because you're a female.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Right. Now, one of the things, you're talking about the mission board a minute ago, and you have done a lot of mission work.
Yes.
You and your wife.
Mostly been overseas.
Yes. Yeah. And you spent a lot of time in Korea.
That's right.
Now, did you select Korea, or did the mission board do that for you?
The answer is that when my wife and I retired from MTSU in the year 2000, to go on what's called, the Southern Baptists call a master's program, which means you get old and they let you be a missionary. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, that's a nice word for it. They had various possibilities. One of the possibilities was in Korea, the Korea mm-hmm. Baptist Theological Seminary. It met what we thought we could do. We chose that. They never had to prove it. They mm-hmm. could have, you know, the Korea Baptist Mission Board, the International Mission Board of the Southern Baptist Convention could have decided, no, that's not suitable.
Mm-hmm.
But they agreed with our choice. It was both choices, I guess.
Okay. Did you get a feel of the culture over there? I'm sure you did while you were there, because you're there a long time.
Yeah, we were there 6 years, and they used to laugh at us and say that we were probably the more Korean of all the missionaries, because we lived in a city named Daejeon, which was mm-hmm. 90 miles south of Seoul. And yes, there was plenty of English around the universities. Mm-hmm. It's their science research center. There's plenty of people who studied in the U.S., this sort of thing. But you walk out of our house and go to the local stores, and nobody's heard any English. You'd better learn some Korean, and you'd better learn how to get by in Korean culture. And see, we worked directly with a Korean Baptist church doing an international congregation, but it made in the Korean Baptist church. Mm-hmm. We got to know the Koreans very well. So, you know, just an example. Now, if you were to, we're next to the police station, and if you were to have an automobile accident out here and somebody ran into your back bumper and bent it up pretty badly, mm-hmm. You call the police and they come make a report, and you've got to have the report, and then you go to the body shop and you get an estimate, mm-hmm. and your insurance company approves the estimate, mm-hmm. and you get it fixed. Not in Korea.
Hmm.
When they run into the back of you, they look at you and they say, well, let's go over to this nearest body shop, and they say, well, it's 50,000 won, which is $400 mm-hmm. or so. To fix it, and the fellow hands you the 50,000 won, and you arrange for it. The police never hear of it. The insurance company never hears of it. Now, they have insurance, but if it's fixable, nobody turns it in.
Is that because the insurance company would rate them higher?
I think it may be that. It may be that the Koreans do not like losing face, like most Asians, Japanese, Chinese, so forth. They don't like to lose face, and it's losing face to have this happen. It's partly they want to keep the insurance comes out because they raise the rates.
Mm-hmm.
So they just simply take care of it on the side.
You have to admire that in them, that they feel that way.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
I had to learn this because this happened to us, and after a while, somebody ran in the back of us. You know, I quickly learned that that's the way they did it. So, okay, well, that's the way they do it. I'll do it that way. I don't care.
When did you start working on the Korean language?
We knew about 6 months before we left that we were going to Korea. So I did a little study on my own, but most of it was done after we got there.
Did you kind of sense any animosity between North and South at that time?
Woo! Any is a mild word. Mm-hmm. There was a extreme amount of animosity. They did not like each other. They have not liked each other since 1950, in the mm-hmm. beginning of the Korean War. There seemed to be some of that even going before the Korean War. I think mm-hmm. that's part of what set off the Korean War. there was not the killing of people that has happened in the last 2 years while we were there, but there were plenty of people who were very hostile towards North Korea who we knew. Intriguing enough, I had to do the funeral for a man who was actually an escapee from North Korea because I knew his family very well. The family in general was not friendly to the modern North Korean government.
Did you get a chance to go to up to the 38th parallel?
Yeah, I've looked across the 38th parallel several times.
How did that feel?
Because at the time I knew it was safe, it didn't bother me much. I think it would have been different if the modern situation in the last 2 years had happened, where you had people being actually killed in attacks on ships, attacks on islands. You know, it would seem to be safe enough. Tricky enough, Americans can go where South Koreans can't, except for the South Korean military. We could go look directly across. They could not go to those same locations.
Would they be a target for snipers?
They were apparently some fear of the government that they might be, and only the military could get that close.
That's an interesting story. I know I've read some of the parts of the Korean War, and it was a brutal war. It really was.
Very, very bad. Everything was torn down. The city we were in, Daejeon, was already a city because it's basically where the railroad lines running due south out of Seoul come to a place where you can go through the passes, either towards Busan to the southeast or Gwangju to the southwest. It was completely, there's one building left in downtown Daejeon. The rest was completely destroyed. It's cold. There wasn't shelter. It was a tough place to be, particularly during the winter.
I was just wondering how you and Jeanette made it through that extreme cold.
Oh, we had a house, and it was heated. It was heated now with old-style radiator heat. Remember your schools where they had the water radiators on the wall?
I love them. That's my favorite of all.
We had those in our house. And it was run off a propane gas boiler. You had to order the propane gas every so often. So you need to know how to call in Korean and get your gas. I mean, you didn't want to run out.
It didn't seem like people used to get as sick during the wintertime when you had those old radiators. I loved them in our schools.
Oh, well, one thing is true. There's more fresh air when you have that, because how do you cool one of those things off? It gets too hot. You raise the window. You can't turn it down and instantly turn it off. I mean, it's going to stay hot for a long while before you cool it off.
I never thought about that. Now, we have another local lady who really did well. Well, she was local here for a while, and that's Sarah Childress Polk. And you have a lot, being a history teacher, you have a lot of knowledge about all of these people.
Sarah's an interesting character. Now, she has the opposite father from Drusilla King. In a real sense, her father was a plantation owner. The plantation actually was off close to where Old Jefferson, which is close to Smyrna. But they had a townhouse in Murfreesboro. I think that was on Academy Street. I'm pretty sure it was. Close to downtown.
Anyway, high rent district.
Well, be honest with you, Murfreesboro was about the square and three blocks all every direction, so it wasn't very far. You could walk anywhere in town easily. But her father insisted that she get an education. And the solution, when she came to college level, and she came to college level in the 1810s, was to send her to Salem College in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, then just Salem, North Carolina.
Before cigarettes.
Yeah, right. When the cigarettes came along, they renamed the town. To get a college degree. She, of course, upper-class lady, college degree, didn't mean she was going to be a professional teacher or anything like that. That would be not, it would be below class level. You just would not do that. While she was still in Murfreesboro in 1814, I guess it was, she met James K. Polk, who's from Columbia, and who was over here at Bradley Academy, which at that time was a we'd say a college preparatory school, mm-hmm. you know, a private school intended to prepare boys for entering college. But apparently just sort of made him. In 1820, mm-hmm. James K. Polk got ready to run for House of Representatives, mm-hmm. U.S. House of Representatives. He had an advantage. Lawyers at that time rode circuit,
hmm.
except in Nashville. Nashville's a big enough town to have mm-hmm. enough business to stay right in one town. So he'd been riding from Columbia to Lewisburg to Lawrenceburg to Pulaski to Waynesboro. And it's basically the same area as his congressional district.
What was his method of transportation at that time?
Horseback. All the lawyers rode around on horseback. The judges rode with them.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody stayed in the same boarding houses, and they ate together, and then they get up and argue, and then they come back that evening and eat together again. You know,
things don't change.
A couple of weeks in Columbia, and then a week in, or two or three days in Waynesboro, and a week in Lawrenceburg, and a week in Lewisburg, and mm-hmm. you know, and Pulaski maybe, and then back to Columbia, and they'd run the circuit again.
Justice is slow now. My goodness,
you had to be ready when the time came. They just put you in jail and let you wait for the judge.
Not the good old days.
He got ready to run for that congressional district down there, and he thought he needed Andrew Jackson's blessing.
Yes.
Now, Jackson's from, you know, Nashville, mm-hmm. not the same district, mm-hmm. but, you know, he's the grand old man already in Tennessee.
Very popular.
Yeah. Very popular.
Yes.
An endorsement, too. And he went to get the endorsement because the Polks and the Jacksons knew each other quite well. The Polks were rather well to do.
Mm-hmm.
Jackson looked at him and said, asked him what he wanted, and he explained. Jackson looked him straight in the eye and said, no, I will not endorse you. Polk says that he hardly knew what to do, but he finally got out, you know, thank you, Mr. Jackson, but why not? And he said, you're not married.
Ooh.
And Jackson had been both a U.S. representative and a senator,
mm-hmm.
and even though he'd served in Philadelphia rather than Washington, that's how far back it was, mm-hmm. he said, Washington's too tough a town for a single man. You just can't go up there single. And Pope said, you know, and stammered around and said, well, you know, I don't really have any prospects. And Jackson says, yes, you do. Jackson actually was quite a matchmaker. And Jackson is actually apparently the one that suggested he go visit Sarah Childress.
Now, I'm sure he had known her from somewhere.
Yeah, the Childresses and the Jacksons knew each other, too.
Oh, okay.
And he happened to apparently know that James K. had met Sarah while he was over at Murfreesboro.
Mm-hmm.
We forget that the number of people in Tennessee at that time was less than the number of people in Nashville today.
Oh, wow.
Everybody who was upper class knew everybody else.
Were most of them still in East Tennessee, or had that changed?
No, actually, the change came between 1800 and 1810.
Mm-hmm.
East Tennessee grew fairly rapidly during that 10 years, and Middle Tennessee just took off like a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And so the majority of the population had moved to Middle Tennessee by 1820. And then, of course, you entered West Tennessee about 1819,
19.
Mm-hmm. And so some of them had just moved across the river. It didn't take too long for Sarah and James K. decided to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And the big event, I think it was January 1, 1922, here was their marriage in Murfreesboro.
It really wasn't one of these marriages that it was already set for them. They actually went through a dating period.
Oh, yeah, I think it was. You know, it was not an arranged marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I've never read much about that. I'm not sure either one of them ever wrote down lots about it.
Mm-hmm.
They're both pretty quiet people. You would almost suspect that James K. and Sarah the idea of a good date was to sit down with two books and each read at the same time.
Extremely bright people. It sounded like they did have a lot in common, though.
Oh, they really did. And both were very, very interested in politics. And Henry Clay, who was not James K.'s friend at all,
mm-hmm.
I mean, in fact, they were enemies basically most of their lives, said the best politician in Washington, D.C. was not a man at all. It was Sarah Childress Polk. She had great talent. If you go out to Oaklands or you go to the Hermitage or you go to any of these older homes and you walk in the main hallway, you'll see two sides to the layout of the rooms. And one side has a sort of a formal living room and probably a dining room on it. And the other side has a men's study and this sort of thing on it. And you'd have these formal dinner parties, and all the men and women would eat together in the dining room. And then afterwards, the men went to the study and smoked their cigars and chewed their tobacco and drank a little dram of liquor. And the women went to the formal dining room and talked about women's matters, except for Sarah. Sarah went with the men to talk politics.
She had to have been an interesting lady. He was lucky to find her.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's the best thing that ever happened to him when he went to talk to Jackson.
I think it was, because she basically ran his campaign for governor, and when he won in 1839, she arranged the speeches. She arranged the stuff. She is distinctly behind a good deal of his nomination for president in 1844, because she was able to call her cards for entertaining so many of these people in Washington, D.C., because they did have a house in Washington, D.C. when most representatives didn't. They had the money to do that. Then she served as his press secretary in the White House, literally press secretary. She read the newspapers every morning, 8 or 10 of them. There were only 3 dailies at the time, so 3 dailies and then weeklies, and she could, in a week, she could cover all the major items, look for national important matters. At lunch, she would tell James K., okay, this is what's going on. Here's some, and she'd literally make recommendations. I recommend that you might want to do such and such. He tended to follow her recommendations. She really was a major part of that administration.
Now, you're talking about they were extremely wealthy for that time.
Yes, they were wealthy.
It seems like during today's time, it's all media. Everything is done, money and media. Those are the two main ingredients.
Right.
Okay, back then, how did you get your name out, and how did you get your qualifications and those other things to make sure that the general public knew what you were all about? And was it more of a political party thing?
The parties certainly were probably more important than they are today in campaigning. I think I need to answer your question on two levels. If you're talking about the state or local level, okay, then a lot of what happens is the party backs you, and people then were very, very, very loyal to the party. You could not trust a man who dared switch from voting Whig to Democrat or Democrat to Whig. You just could not trust that man. You couldn't trust him in a business deal or anything else. So you tended to have a block of voters you could depend on. You had to win those few who weren't as well decided, or get out a bigger percentage of your block to win. Lots of that on the state and local level actually is done by campaigning. They simply went out and met the people. They made speeches. They moved from, if it's a governor's race, they moved from town to town to town speaking. If you get to a national level, however, lots of it is newspapers.
They were powerful back then.
They were very, very powerful. They were the kingpins of media. There wasn't a radio. There wasn't a television. There wasn't an internet or anything like that. So basically, they were the power brokers. And you had Democratic Party newspapers, you had Whig newspapers, and you had some neutral newspapers. And you went out and got that newspaper's endorsement, and they endorsed you. You had a big advantage.
And what's so amazing about that, you're just talking about just a few people with each newspaper, and they were making the decisions for everybody else. And that's why it's always been fascinating to me.
They might be just the editor and a few typesetters and two or three writers, and that'd be all the newspaper really was as far as
personnel. I bet Ms. Polk had a lot of influence with those papers, the way that you've been explaining, the way she was.
Yes, she certainly did. And they liked the fact that they could depend on her for the women's reading. By then, lots of women were educated enough to read. Okay, and they liked the fact that she dealt well with them, honestly with them. I think that's really true.
And she, there's no doubt she could relate well with them. Oh, yeah. Very educated.
They're very educated. Probably better educated than most of the editors. Really,
I think that goes without saying. We're going to take a quick break and let you know that part of this show is brought to you by Pirtle and Howard and Automotive. And that's Mark and John. And they're at 2006 North Main Street. And that's in Shevable, Tennessee. And just before you get into downtown, they're on the left. And if you're looking for a Ford, Mercury, Chevrolet, Buick, or GMC, well, I tell you what, first of all, call them. They're at 1-800-264-6800, and that's toll-free. Or you can pull them up on the PirtleHowerton.com internet. That's PirtleHowerton.com. And find out exactly what they've got, and I'll guarantee you, they'll have exactly what you want. And it's one of those days that maybe you don't want to get out too much, but get out of the house. I mean, it's getting boring inside. Take you a quick trip to Shevable, and on the left, go in and talk to the nice people. Have a cup of coffee. Maybe they even got some hot chocolate there. You can sit down and talk about your needs, and I'll guarantee you it'll be a whole lot smoother ride coming back today in the car you're coming back in and the one you left with.
Get a magical deal on fixing your hail-damaged vehicle. Dent Magic will give you a $100 gift card for Christmas shopping for every repair. Couldn't you use the extra cash and get your hail damage fixed? Dent Magic will repair your vehicle in 2 days without drilling holes. They've got an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and will even pay your deductible. Some restrictions apply. Oh, did I mention Dent Magic will give you a $100 gift card for Christmas shopping for every repair? Dent Magic, 1 mile west of Coles on Old Fort Parkway in the old fire station. Dent Magic, the industry leader in paintless dent repair at hailmagic.com.
Murfreesboro Medical Clinic is more than just a clinic. It's the doctors you can trust, a technician you can believe in, and a staff member who goes the extra mile. From the time someone walks in our doors, the difference becomes evident. All of our resources are used to improve the healthcare experience of our patients, and we have been a part of Rutherford and surrounding counties for over 60 years. Murfreesboro Medical Clinic.
Murfreesboro.
Hello, this is Jim Bryan at First Bank.
And I'm Chuck Lewis. First Bank presents Good Neighbor Events, news of what our local schools, churches, and community groups are doing.
The Riverdale Junior ROTC is collecting winter coats. Bring those cleaned, good condition coats by Riverdale High School. This is a service of the Riverdale Junior ROTC. And we're getting closer to the deadline to enter the Bicentennial Christmas Parade. The entries for the Bicentennial Christmas Parade must be at WGNS by 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Wednesday, November the 30th. Entry forms and regulations are at WGNSradio.com. Look across the blue bar in the upper section of the page and click on Parade. The parade is Sunday, December 11th at 2 o'clock. And since this is the 30th anniversary for the annual Bethlehem Marketplace, Southeast Baptist Church has expanded those performance days. It's on Saturday and Sunday, December 3rd and 4th, as well as 10th and 11th, from 1 until 5 each afternoon, and it's absolutely free. Southeast Baptist Church is at 708 Minerva Drive. What a phenomenal Christmas gift for our community. Now listen closely. Santa will be arriving on the historic Murfreesboro Square Friday night, December the 2nd. In addition to Santa being there, some great Christmas music, and the lighting of our county Christmas tree on the square. That's all on Friday night, December the 2nd, from 6 until 9 in the evening on the Murfreesboro Square. And the Oakland's Historic House Museum Candlelight Tour of Homes is Saturday, December 3rd, from 4 until 8 in the evening. And on cold winter nights, the WGNS Blanket Brigade gives out new blankets to homeless people. Bring those new blankets by WGNS. We're at 306 South Church, next to the city police.
Weather Eye.
Mainly cloudy this afternoon with areas of light rain. Temperatures hold fairly steady. Cloudy tonight, chance of seeing some rain, may even see some light snow mixing in. Low 35. I'm WGNS meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Right now it's 43.
And today's special at Kirk & Burt's is our award-winning smoked wings. This is Tom. Come over and get you some. They're just 40 cents each. That's Kirk & Burt's, 517 Cason Lane, just down from the theater. Or call in your order at 893-FOOD.
You've known him for years. Now you can visit with him every day. It's The Truman Show, continuing right now on WGNS, AM and FM.
With today's guest, Dr. Fred Rollinger.
All right, I want to let you know as we start the second half of the show, it's brought to you by Stan McNabb Automotive, where they provide quality vehicles from Chevrolet, Dodge, Jeep, Ford, and Cadillac to the Murfreesboro, McMinnville, and Shevel, Tennessee area. Their large selection ensures that they have a vehicle for everyone, no matter what it is you're looking for. And for a quality used car in Tullahoma, visit their dealership located at 2000 North Jackson Street. They have a large inventory of pre-owned cars, trucks, SUVs, and minivans to select from. And at Stan McNabb Automotive, they pride themselves in the quality that they offer on all of their used cars, which makes them a major destination for used vehicles. And only at Stan McNabb can you get free oil changes and free tires for the life of that vehicle. Now, we have so many interesting places that we can go now, Fred, because there is no way that we can cover everything that we were going to cover today. The development of public school education in Tennessee, and Don Rutledge, who evidently is somebody that you have a lot of special feelings for.
Yeah, Don Rutledge is an interesting character. I think if this was 1950-55, mm-hmm. I could have found 1,000 people in Murfreesboro and Rutherford County who had known him. Mm-hmm. I think today I probably can't find 11. Not 11,000. I can't find 11 who know him.
Now, why did so many people know him at that time?
Because he was from Rutherford County. Mm-hmm. He grew up. He was born in 1931 out about 8 miles west of Murfreesboro, out sort of towards the Franklin Road, mm-hmm. you know, on a farm.
Yeah.
His family did own the farm. They weren't tenant farmers, mm-hmm. but they were not well-to-do people either. Mm-hmm. It's an old line family. His grandfather had been a Confederate soldier from Rutherford County. You know, he, mm-hmm. you know, that's... thus the family was known. His father had a hard time. His father basically was an alcoholic. The depression was so difficult on everybody. Mm-hmm. Mama kept them together by getting the four kids, I believe it was, to school and to church. And they went to the old Westview Baptist Church, which was, it's now Bellwood Baptist. Mm-hmm. There's a Westview Baptist now, but it's a different organization. Oh, okay. A different group.
Where Jim Avery's church
was. Right, yeah, mm-hmm. right, yeah. And he got into school. Don inherited his grandfather's temper.
Good or bad?
In this instance, it was probably bad. he did not like to be picked on. He was fairly small. He was thin. He was not below average height, but thin. And some of the boys, when he got to Central High School, began to pick on him pretty badly. So he brought him along a 2x4 one day and whopped a few of them with it, which got him in rather serious trouble. But they handled it the typical way of schools back then. They just made him stay after school. They made him work it off. They didn't send him down the juvenile delinquency place. Mm-hmm. And then later on, he got bad enough, he brought him along a knife, and he was going to stab one of them. Well, uh-oh. Baxter Hobgood, who was principal, got a hold of him.
Remember him well.
Right, mm-hmm. and for Baxter to manhandle him, you know he couldn't have been too big because mm-hmm. Baxter himself was not a big man. Yeah. He was sort of a small man. But he manhandled him, got the knife away from him, got him calmed down, and decided that, okay, we got to give this kid who's a smart kid something to do. Mm-hmm. He gets in trouble because he's bored, mm-hmm. you know. And so he tells the Don that they need somebody to be the photographer for the yearbook. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you have the professional who does each of the pictures, but somebody takes pictures of sporting events. And mm-hmm. social clubs and, you know, this sort of thing. Somebody in the school does that. I want you to be the photographer. He didn't know a thing about photography, but he did know, have an uncle who had a camera.
Well, that was a plus.
So he went down and borrowed the camera and bought some film. My uncle showed him how to operate it, and he began to take pictures. Well, he decided to literally love to take pictures. I mean, he did a good job, and the yearbooks are quite well done in comparison to most yearbooks. The 2 years he did that. Well, he got in strong in church, and the preacher said, you know, you'd make a good preacher. And so he sent him off to Tennessee Temple, which is down into Chattanooga. Mm-hmm. And he got a 4-year degree back, and he came back and was pastor of, they called it Manny Avenue Baptist. Then it's Oakland Baptist Church. It's on Manny Avenue. Okay. And even then, that was lower working class neighborhood.
Manny?
Yeah, right.
Oh, wow.
Right. North Manny was...
Oh, okay.
This is North Manny, not
okay.
South Manny.
Okay. Right.
This is North Manny. It's the white area of town. But it wasn't out where... It's not out where the rich ones live, close to Oakland. Mm-hmm. It's the working class neighborhood. Mm-hmm. They couldn't pay him enough to make a living wage, and he got married, and he had to do something. So he started taking photographs, and he began to operate with the Black Star Photographic Agency. Now, Black Star was the big New York City African-American photography agency.
That's the first I've ever heard of it.
And, it was big stuff. I mean, they ran Ebony, just to give you the idea. They supplied the photographs.
Yeah.
They supplied the photographs. They didn't own the magazine. Big time photographs. And they had him doing all sorts of, it's a stringer situation. I mean, they call him, oh, we need this such and such photographs. But he was fiddling out his income pretty well doing this. And a fellow named Giffen came along and said he wanted to go to Mississippi and do a photograph. He was a white man, but he was going to take this medicine and make him look black. He was going to investigate. And Don Rutledge is the photographer for Black Like Me, which was at that time a very big bestseller book. he became very good.
Mm-hmm.
In about 1970... the Southern Baptist Home Mission Board decided they needed a photographer. They really hadn't had one. They'd been doing the same thing. Stringers had been doing it. Mm-hmm. And so they scraped up enough money and hired him, and he moved to Atlanta, and he spent probably 10 years down there, and then went with the International Mission Board out of Richmond, Virginia. And for 20 years, he just traveled the world. He was in 140 countries, all the states. He took all sorts of photographs. He won probably 50 major photography prizes.
Mm-hmm.
He ran Stringer for National Geographic for many, many years.
Good night.
I mean, you're talking about amazingly high-level photography. I mean, so lots of these things are still out there. They're still being reproduced. And yet, I suspect he's a Murfreesboro boy, a Rutherford County boy, really, who went to school eventually in Murfreesboro, who almost nobody knows.
I had never heard of him before, but when you mentioned National Geographic, those pictures will be known forever.
Forever.
Because
that's
everybody
right.
that has taken National Geographic for any time at all, they'll have just... a whole room full of those.
Oh,
books.
Yeah. I think we've got 25 years in one of our rooms, you know, and wondering what we can do with them. The problem is you can't get away because everybody else is interested and already has that same collection.
Does his family remain here in this area?
I
know there were a number of Rutledge's families when I
there was
growing
a brother, but I think the brother died fairly young. I don't think there's immediate family in the area, but I do think there are cousins who live in the area.
Right. That's amazing. And then you go back to what really got him started and influenced him, started in the school system with Mr. Baxter Hopgood.
Yeah, the principal's just looking for something to keep this good kid out of trouble because he kept getting in trouble because he's bored.
And the influence of the teachers and education on the kids goes well beyond what we look at today. I mean, they've got test scores, and they rate everybody from the superintendent on down and to the kids. And it has gotten to be, was going to say comical, but that's not the right word.
I don't think comical is the right word to use anymore. Oh, yeah, the college teachers. I've had evaluations of all my classes this year already, and I'll do it next semester, too. And the biggest problem, it looks like to me, is they've decided that the only way to evaluate education is to evaluate it on a corporate basis. And if you're running an industry and you look at a line here and you've got 10 people assigned to run this mm-hmm. line and it produces 500 units in an hour, mm-hmm. and you look at the next line, it's only producing 400 units an hour, and you know the lines are the same, mm-hmm. then you start looking at the quality of the personnel. Why can't these people produce as much as that person? Mm-hmm. And from an industry point of view, that's a perfectly logical thing to do. Okay. I mean, you know, their product is, if you go to, Pillsbury, their product is food,
right?
A certain type of food. If you go to, International Paper out here, their product is cardboard boxes. Mm-hmm. But the problem with it is the product for a teacher is not measurable in the same way.
Right.
I'm sorry, but you can't measure everything a person knows but what they can write down on a multiple choice test. You cannot do that. For one thing, they need to have ability in their brains to integrate that into some sort of reasonable mm-hmm. way. And you can't do that without asking questions that allow a free answer. And you can't grade that very well. It's just doesn't work very good for evaluations. And what you do is train a large number of elementary and high school students just to take multiple choice tests.
Mm-hmm.
We can do this, we can do that, we can do the other. Math may work a little better because you can say, you know, here's a type of problem that should work for the third grader, here's a type of problem for the eighth grader or 12th grade, and see if they can work it. But the truth is, what they normally do now, even in math tests, is give you a set of possible answers, and you sort of figure enough to figure, well, that's got to be the right answer, and mark that and go to the next question. They don't look at what the math teacher used to look at. He used to look at your process. You wrote it down for him.
Mm-hmm.
Here's step by step by step by step. And if you got there accidentally right but wrong steps, they'd back up and say you don't have it. You know. But even more, a teacher's product is inside the brain and the heart and soul of a student. That's what you train. They're going to be out there, and I'm going to give you an example. I taught in 1987 in Japan, and they had a system for education very much like our system. You lockstepped it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they drilled it into you, and you learned and you drilled it in. And if you stood out in any way, they sort of hammered you down to get you level. Mm-hmm. And I said the big difference between Japan and the U.S. is going to come out when that fellow goes out and he's going to be a office machine repairman.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got to fix this copier.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as the problem with the copier is a mechanical problem, the Japanese fella can fix it as mm-hmm. good or better than the U.S. fella.
Mm-hmm.
But just let him get out there and it doesn't fit what he's been trained.
Mm. Yeah.
Now, that good old farm boy from Tennessee who'd had a teacher who sort of taught him to think a little bit would sit down and figure until he figured out, now it's got to be this problem, I'll fix that. Okay.
Yeah, I know.
The Japanese would go back and have the engineers run a test to figure out what was wrong.
Hmm.
In the meantime, the Japanese business is out of their copier for 2 months, maybe. And the U.S. machine is up and operating. You know. because the fellow learned how to think. You've got to teach them to think, and we are, with our lockstep system, we are not teaching them to think in that way. Once they get to college, the college professors turn the screws on to try it. Okay.
Well, now that's the estrogen process. Once they change from the environment of high school into college, what does that do to you as a professor?
Well, first of all, you have to teach them that's not the way you take tests. Mm-hmm. You've got to learn. You've got to learn the facts, but you've got to learn to put them together. Mm-hmm. When I asked them at the end of Tennessee history, what three Tennesseans and two Tennessee events you consider most important and why, they've got to not only name them, they've got to tell me something about it. Then they've got to tell me why they're so important. That's not in anybody's book. They've got to think. And I'm doing it more to make them think than to grade them on the test. You've got to learn to use the knowledge you acquire so that it works with whatever you're working at. You were a sheriff, you had to have your knowledge of people in order to figure out, now this person couldn't have done that, but that other person surely could have. Right. We better look at him. Maybe he's not the real person who did this crime, but he's a suspect because he might do it, okay? But that's a thinking process.
So in our schools right now, we're talking about
elementary, K through 12.
Yeah. Basically, what they're doing is structuring them with kind of blinders on, and they're having to aim toward that one particular end, and they're not able to adjust.
I think some of the best teaching occurs when somebody asks a question and we get completely off the line, but they learn something, than me following the exact lines. And in almost every discipline, that's true. Again, I was a college math minor. I understand that there's certain things that you have to learn by block, but the great majority of the world doesn't operate that way.
I know when most kids, when they go to college, they're in their early 20s. Most of them are.
Yeah.
Do you find them as interested in history as people, say, who are older and are more experienced and they can relate more to the history?
Well, I've told many a student is, I know you're not happy now. I know that you are taking this course because it's a required course, but I'm going to win this ball game. You're going to get to age 30 or 35 and all of a sudden something's going to click. And you're going to realize that time makes a difference in your life. And you're going to get interested in whether it's the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, Tennessee history, whatever it is. And I've had many, many of them walk up later and say, Dr. Alder, I had you in class at such and such time. I sort of struggled through. But now this is what I'm interested in. And they will tell me that I won the game. I didn't win it right away. Okay.
I think as you get older, you just kind of get that broad perspective, and you want to know how things have occurred and got you to where you are.
Well, that's right.
I just wish I had had more interest in it when I was younger. And want to let you know that the last part of the show is brought to you by At Home Care. And what they do is they come in when you're no longer able to take care of the normal functions at home, and they'll do that for you. They'll do all your housework and do your errands for you so that you can remain at home and still have a great quality of life. And if you're interested in that, give them a call at 237 Castlewood Drive, Suite H, and the telephone number is 713-4639, or check them out on the internet, www.athomecaretennessee.com, and I guarantee you they'll make your life a whole lot better.
This is Brandon Burks with First Bank Mortgage. Now is the time to refinance or purchase your dream home with rates at historic lows. Just a quick 10-minute call or visit could help you save thousands in interest and even reduce your monthly mortgage payment. Give me a call at 907-5535 or come by and visit me at First Bank on Memorial Boulevard. I look forward to helping you with all your mortgage needs. Call me, Brandon Burks, at 907-5535.
Stop by Southeastern Tire Service before you head off for your winter travels this year. We're a full-service repair facility, so we can get your car in tip-top condition before you head out. Also, from October 31st until November 28th, when you buy four Michelin tires, you'll get a $70 prepaid MasterCard through mail-in rebate. That's at Southeastern Tire Service on Broad Street across from Advance Auto. Southeastern Tire Service, serving Murfreesboro and Rutherford County since 1950. Visit southeasterntireservice.net.
He knows Rutherford County, and he knows the people of Rutherford County. Truman Jones, here on WGNS AM and FM.
This has been a very good show today. Of course, with Fred Rolter, it's always good. And I guess that we would be remiss if we didn't mention that Bethlehem Marketplace will be starting this Sunday. This weekend, Saturday and Sunday, I'm sorry. In fact, the next two weekends. Next two weekends. And it starts at 1 o'clock, is that right?
That's 1 to 5.
And it'll be on all 4 days.
All 4 days.
Saturday, Sunday, and then Saturday and Sunday of the next week. And it is a present that Southeast Baptist gives to the community. And it's not just the community. They come in from everywhere, even outside the state of Tennessee. And basically what you do is you go back during the time when Jesus was born and how everything was back then. And,
right.
and all the people from the Southeast Baptist that will be in there, they will basically be trying to sell you things from that era. You'll see the baby Jesus. You'll see people dressed up as they would have been 2,000 years ago in that area. And it's just really a fun and interesting thing to do.
Absolutely. And it's absolutely free. You can't give us money.
No, but Southeast Baptist will give you something.
We're trying to give a gift to the community.
And it is a great gift. And we will see you tomorrow at 2 o'clock, and Mr. Greg Tucker will be here. And I've got a feeling we'll be talking about the post office. We'll see you.